Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Reviews Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
And this week, we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of reviews, which is a pretty big part of what we do over here at Engadget. And we'll be talking about the Surface Pro 7.
It's a Windows tablet.
The Pixel 4.
Google's latest flagship.
The XPS 13 2-in-1.
Perfect portable laptop.
And the Vive Cosmos.
Really weird VR headset.
And a whole bunch of other things, too.
Other things.
Other things. Tell us what you think about these reviews and everything else we're doing over in Engadget at podcastengadget.com. Be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave us a review, because that's always super helpful for every podcast. So, Sherlyn, let's talk about the Surface Pro 7, which you got while I was taking a few days off for my daughter's first birthday. So that was a fun thing. I missed playing with the Surface Pro 7, though. I don't know what was more meaningful, my daughter's first birthday or Surface Pro 7?
I'm going to take a wager of $100 and say it's Sophia's first birthday that's more important.
Because, no, most definitely.
Because first of all, this wasn't even that interesting an upgrade. Surface Pro 7, the Surface Pro line has been, you know, really well established for being the best, I think, Windows tablet around that also can be a laptop replacement if you need it. Mm-hmm. The Surface Pro 6 you really liked, and, you know, it performs well, it lasts long, it's got a great screen, got a great build, the best keyboard cover in the market, and the Surface Pro 7 has a lot of that stuff, right? But it finally introduces USB-C. USB-C.
Just one port.
USA. USB-C.
I will say Sherlyn's very excited about this because Microsoft has been kind of slow to adapt to this port, because it showed up on a couple of things. It showed up on the Surface Go last year. It's been on the Surface Book. But when it comes to charging, it's really only been the Surface Go. And I personally hate Microsoft's weird power adapter thing on the Surfaces. So to have like a nice standard thing, that's a big help. So we at least finally get that on the Surface Pro 7.
It's really nice because I have a USB-C charger for my phone and my laptops at home and in the office. So now I can charge the Pro 7. So, but the thing is though, like the most outstanding thing about the Pro 7 is the USB-C, which is sad, right? Like here you go, a new Surface Pro 7 this year. Here's what we did. Mm-hmm. USB-C. Meanwhile, also, new processors that are a lot faster than before, like significantly so based on the benchmark test
These are Intel's 10th generation
chips. Exactly, the 10th generation chips. But they came at the expense of battery life, which is weird. Like, we ran our battery, I had to run it 3 times. And these are overnight tests because, like, they generally last at least, like, 12 hours or 15 hours on the Pro 6. Our Pro 7 lasted, like, an average of about 8.5 hours maybe, which is a massive drop. So
from what, like, 12 or 13?
From 15 on the Surface Pro 6. Yeah. The Surface Pro 6 had 15. And I tested it at all levels of the battery performance. So it was, like, max battery life or max power. And on max power or performance, you're getting, like, 750. So it's weird. It's a mixed bag, I want to say. But, it's still a really good Windows tablet.
Still really good. I feel like partially we may be a little spoiled by the Surface Pro line because Microsoft has been doing such a great job with these. When this basic design came out, that was it's basically the Surface Pro, the one before, was it?
I think it had no name. It had no number attached to it.
Yeah, the Surface Pro, it was a really nice design. The only thing is, I wish they had thinned out the display bezels a bit, made it look a little more modern, but still, really nice. Like, it's a thin machine, maybe chunky for a laptop or chunky for a tablet. But as far as laptops go, it still feels really thin. They probably didn't have much room to optimize. And also, the Surface Pro X is coming. And I feel like that's the one where they really took their design to another level, right?
I will say this, having seen the Pro X in a hands-on, yes, the Pro X is far thinner, just much more attractive.
Because it's running a mobile processor.
Exactly. So it probably has more room to, shave off of the chassis. The Pro 7 is, I agree, still very thin and light, still very sturdy. And for a laptop replacement, it's one of the best designed ones out there. Mm-hmm. But again, like you said, chunky bezels make it look really dated. And also, who is the competition now for the Pro 7? Right?
Yeah.
It's not just any, Windows running tablet anymore, because there's so few of those nowadays. It really is a laptop. It's a laptop like the XPS 13 2-in-1 that you mentioned, or like others that I've seen recently that I can't yet tell you
or
about.
Or even like the iPad Pro, which is Apple's attempt to really make a Surface-like device, even though they ragged on them for so long. So, and they're also much more expensive than the Surface Pro 7. So
it's also still like a terrible, terrible thing that Microsoft is doing, which is making you pay extra, like $160 for the type cover.
They really got to stop doing that.
Because who's going to use that tablet?
You're not going to buy a Surface without a keyboard. Yeah, so it should be bundled. Like, even if the price were, if the starting price were a little higher, I feel like that would be more honest.
So right now it's $750 for the Core i3 model. If you bundled in the keyboard.
Never buy the Core i3, never. But yes.
If you bundled in the keyboard and started it at like, maybe even like $850, $900, people would be more open to that, I think.
Sure.
But anyway, that was my wonderful weekend with the Surface Pro 7.
Yeah, we got that kind of late, and Sherlyn basically spent most of last weekend writing it up. So what else have you been playing with, Sherlyn? I know we saw the Pixel 4 recently. Our review just went up over that, too.
Yeah, so that was another weekend deal where I didn't review it. Chris Velasco did. And
he is currently just in a puddle somewhere.
Poor guy,
in his house.
Recovering.
Yeah.
Maybe working on another review. Yeah. Can't tell you guys yet. But I was also playing with the Pixel 4 over the weekend, trying to help him out and, getting some testing of Face Unlock done. And I did publish a story on Monday about how Face Unlock just was really bad for me. Mm-hmm. First of all, Face Unlock, the fact that you can unlock your phone with your eyes closed, that was a huge glaring flaw. And so this week, the company finally was like, oh, God, yeah, that's a huge problem. So they announced that it's adding a mandatory eye detection feature to Face Unlock, and that's coming soon. We're not sure how
soon.
That's
so Google. Like, we have this secure face encryption. We forgot about the eyes.
We forgot about the eyes. Well, okay, so that's one of the issues with Face Unlock, right? And at least Google is aware and trying to fix it. Here's my slate of other problems with the way the Pixel 4 sees my face. First of all, I'm a girl that likes her makeup, right? And I, look somewhat different when I have my makeup on and I don't.
Is it judging you? Is it like you're going out in that?
It just doesn't recognize me. It just straight up is like when you have your. So I set up Face Unlock twice. Once, the first time I set it up with my makeup on because I was at the event. I went home, washed my face, tried to use the phone, could not get in.
Honestly, this is surprising too because the way like Apple's Face ID works, it is like a three-dimensional render of your face, like makeup. Those things shouldn't matter, right? Because it knows the mapping of your face. Does Google's just work differently? Is that the problem?
I believe because it's using the radar sensor.
Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm not fully up to speed on, like, the actual differences here. I will say that, like, I encounter this problem sometimes with, like, Windows Hello. But that's, like, also an optical image.
But it's also using a 3D depth sensor.
Right.
Camera,
so it's
right?
It's not just because I look different. It's something about the texture of my face might be different because I have makeup on. So these 3D depth maps are like, what the heck is up with your face? But listen, I get it. That's fine. The thing is, though, with the iPhone or with like a Windows laptop, I can add a secondary face.
Sure.
Which it could be me with makeup, face one, me without makeup, face two. But on the Pixel 4, you can only have one face. So if you are,
I believe
going,
the iPhone works the same way too. So it's not just
no. The iPhone allows you to add one alternate look. I had to research this very deeply. Okay. Anyway, if you've invested in a Pixel 4, you've set up Face Unlock. This Halloween, good luck. Make sure you remember your PIN if you want to be like, some person from The Office and you're going to change up your face, or Avatar, or you want to be a gremlin.
Maybe we should just not be doing face authentication at all. Like, it seems like a bad idea. We have in-glass fingerprint sensors now. Like, let's just use those.
That brings me to my second problem with Face Unlock, which is a huger issue, which is a massive issue. Okay, so when Apple replaced fingerprints or Touch ID on the iPhone X completely with Face ID, it did it at an iOS level. It did it by saying that any app that works with Touch ID will work with Face ID because the authentication, the part that says, yes, you're who you say you are, is happening at the OS level. So all the apps had to do was just ping the OS, hey, is this person who they say they are? Yes or no.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Google somehow, I haven't got a clear answer from the company. I've asked already, and I haven't got a clear answer from the company on how this really actively works. You have to use their biometric prompt, which sounds like it works at the OS level, except for all the developers still have to enable it individually.
It almost sounds like Google's bad at hardware.
No, this is software. What are you talking about?
Well, it is the hardware-software interaction.
It's a conundrum.
This is what I'm talking about several episodes ago.
I know, but Also, Google makes more innovations than Apple does. We'll keep listen. And don't interrupt me, Devendra.
You're the Google fan, and you're here over because just ragging on their latest flagship phone.
Because I want it to do better. All right, listen. Also, because I can be just and fair, because that is my job.
Maybe it's a disappointing phone.
Wait, here's the thing. So all these apps, it is a disappointing phone. Mm-hmm. All these, you know, the fact that touch or fingerprint sensors are completely removed from the Pixel 4 is a massive problem, especially because, you know, with apps like your bank app, your credit card app, your Evernote, your secret keeping app, these are going to keep requesting that you sign in over and over again because they want to protect your device or your sensitive information better. And that's great. But then now you have to remember your, like, probably 26 hexa-character, you know, alphanumeric code. And you got to keep typing it in over and over again on the Pixel 4. And honestly, that's not the best thing for security. I don't think it's
not. It's not great at all. By the way, everybody, this is not a sponsored thing, but LastPass, LastPass, or some sort of password manager, it will make your life easier.
For my own security purposes, I'm not going to tell the whole world what password manager I use, but I use a password manager, and it helps. It does help. Mm-hmm. But when there are things like Touch ID, when fingerprint sensors help you, why, you know, use them. So anyway.
Okay, so that's a shame. Well, what else? I think there were a couple cool things, like what you both were talking about last week. The radar sensor on the Pixel 4 for, like, motion gestures and things like that. Does that actually work out well?
I love the idea of motion sensors.
But the implementation.
It works really well. That sensor is one of the most sensitive things in, like, I've tested on a
device.
Does
it actually work? Does it do the things Google says it's
supposed
to do?
It does. Okay. I think I have the same issues with V from, you know, before, which is that they don't have, you know, they haven't implemented it as widely as we want to, you know, see it work yet. So it works with, like, your media players. And yes, you know, swiping it, it's very active. I play with, like, so you have to install a live wallpaper featuring a Pokemon. And then you can interact with it by, like, swiping in front of the phone. And then, like,
that's,
you're, like,
innovation.
Pretend stroking your Pikachu.
No comment.
Oh, boy. I just realized what I said. So anyway, so when you, like, wave your hand in front of the phone, the Pikachu, like, will follow the action of your hand pretty accurately. And then there's this, like, trail of stars just kind of, like, following your hand as you move. And it all makes it feel like, yeah, this thing is, like, it really knows where I am. The other thing, the most intriguing thing for me about Motion Sense is how it enables the Pixel 4 to be always aware that you're reaching for it. That reach action is actually really well detected. Anytime I kind of, like, reach for my phone, I can see my always on display just come on with more notifications than before. And it's just insane. It feels very intuitive.
This seems like something I think we'll see probably more phones going forward, just because everything about phone innovations so far has been about touch, has been about, like, the way you feel and interact with it. So radar sensing, Samsung was showing off things like this that were camera-based a couple years ago. Never worked out so well. I feel like radar is a much better way to go about that.
Yeah, Samsung's thing was Air Command, and just was like, whoa.
That was like Galaxy S3, mm-hmm. Air Command.
No, it was not good, like you said, because it used a poorer sensor. Yeah. And I think LG G8X, the LG version, which used a Z camera, like, which was a 3D depth sensing type camera, mm-hmm. also didn't work really well. I don't think those were the right sensors to go with, and I think Google may have figured out how to get a good sensor in there for this to work. So maybe, you know, moving forward.
How are the cameras? Like, Google, at least the Pixel cameras have been good, right?
Excellent. Excellent. I can't even, have y'all, I'm sure everybody's seen, and you probably have seen, these astrophotography mode photos. Mm-hmm. So first of all, astrophotography mode, like its name suggests, allows you to take pictures of stars, right? And that is usually a very difficult endeavor because
that's impossible for cameras.
It's like, because these stars, they move in the night sky. They're, you know, you have to be, like, near pitch black to even see them with your own eyes. So,
and camera sensors are so finicky, like, you have to do it on a tripod typically,
yes.
right?
So how Google has enabled this is the mode is, you know, obviously long exposing your camera. So you're, like, having it, the lens open for a lot longer than normal. You know, it sets the light sensitivity to, like, way, way, way high. So it's, like, looking for any flicker of light at all. And when Google, like, sent out the review units, they also included a tripod. So clearly, You're supposed to put this on a stable surface. So do that. And then when you hit record on the astrophotography mode, it will start like a 4-minute capture session.
Okay. So this is not a handheld thing.
Dude, no.
Okay.
If you want to hold something up for 4 minutes, by all means do it.
But no, it's not going to be good because you need to be perfectly stable.
Exactly. Because if you move, your picture is not going to come out crisp at all. I will say that the algorithm, the processing side of it is amazing. Like all of these pictures have come out so beautiful. I think not just because we're able to see stars in the night sky for the first time in these pictures, but also because Google's done a lot of work in the processing to make these look good.
So it sounds like an impressive feature, but yeah, I mean, we live in New York. We barely see any stars.
It was so hard to test.
I don't know
this
how often, maybe, you know, if you live in the suburbs or in the country, like this could be more useful or when you're hiking or something. This seems like a very small feature that's just computationally impressive, but maybe not something people
like
are going to use all the time.
Exactly. Unless you're going to Burning Man and like wandering out in the middle of the desert, then this will come in handy. Otherwise, no. Otherwise, yeah. Astrophotography is really just a novelty, almost gimmicky. The problem with this thing is like, girl, I'm not here taking photos of the night sky. I'm like, look, I want to take pictures of my face. Listen, yeah. All right. I take more selfies than most people. I get that. But say you're, you know, taking a photo of you and your baby, you and your friends at a thing. All right, you don't want the camera to be distorting your face, but that's what the Pixel 4 does to me.
Really?
Huh. So I first noticed this issue with the Pixel 3, and it was a major reason why I took so long to switch over. The Pixel 3 had a wide-angle selfie camera in addition to the primary lens. So it was correcting for wide-angle distortion, which, you know, makes sense. But when I was doing that, it was also squishing my face. So instead of looking like a nice round pancake, I look like a squished up pancake. It's very weird. So I have pictures to prove this. If y'all want to see it, let me know. But the Pixel 4, I thought, because it doesn't have a wide angle lens or the, you know, the secondary one, might not have this issue. No, it's worse. Now it's actually like just baked into the system. On the Pixel 3, I was able to use a third party app to like take a photo of my face that looked normal. On the Pixel 4, because of something like live HDR and like the dual exposure that's happening on the viewfinder, it seems like this, you know, tweaking of your features or your face or the wide angle distortion or correction is happening at like a lower level, a more underlying software level for the camera. And so when I use Instagram to take like a selfie video with the Supreme phone that we got in recently, it was distorting my face. Like my face, you can see in real time, my face looks normal and then it just engorges and it's really weird. So listen,
Have you talked to Google about this?
I've asked them.
Yeah.
I've asked and
Mr.
they don't
Sundar
have...
Mr. Sundar Pichai, why are my faces?
My faces. I have asked them. Google said they need some time to get back to me about the whole like underlying software level camera question. And they still haven't gotten back to me and it's... I asked him on Monday and it's Thursday.
He had another Google hardware problem. Interesting.
I mean.
Interesting.
Listen, why do you keep saying it's a hardware problem? It's a software problem.
Okay.
Which also runs counter to my whole point.
Let me say this again. So hardware works based on its software. So, okay, maybe it's not specifically a problem with the camera module, but it's certainly a problem with the way Google's interacting with the hardware.
So software.
So to me, it's all.
So it's how it's processing.
Okay. I feel like this
is code that it's written to take care of the software.
This is being pedantic, but I feel like this is why Sherlyn is such a big fan of Google, because I'm sure their engineers are looking at this too and like, not seeing the fundamental usability problem.
I do think here's what I mean by it's a software problem. It's something that can be fixed if they wrote the right code.
Sure.
And
no, you're right.
You know what I mean? Like the phone feels great. You know what I mean?
The phone feels great. I will say, they finally have two rear camera lenses,
yes,
which is nice.
The big argument on Twitter, which is apparently where I spend all my time, is, you know, Google has chosen that a telephoto lens instead of a wide angle on the back, where everyone else has done wide angle as well. And
because
so,
everyone else did telephoto. Well, iPhone did telephoto last year with the iPhone 10. Yeah.
But wide angle is much more versatile on things like the Galaxy phones or OnePlus.
And that's what the iPhone 11 has. The base iPhone 11 has ultra wide angle and like the traditional wide angle.
Because people want to take photos of landscapes.
Sure. It's very nice. It's very helpful. It is also super helpful baby photos. Yeah.
Listen, on this point, I'll let you have it.
I'm not even making a point. I'm just pointing out.
That, right. But yeah. I know you're not making a point, but I'm like having a realization right now where I'm like, listen, Google, come on. This one hardware problem, y'all can fix with the next Pixel 4 or 4A or whatever that might be on the way. This is a hardware problem. Hardware problem means you have to wait for the next generation to fix. So,
as I like to say, told ya. One other thing I want to mention for Pixel 4 is that 90 hertz screen, which mm-hmm. I find, I love high refresh rate screens. What that means is everything looks smoother, right? The screen just refreshes at a faster rate. So scrolling up and down a web page or something, like it, you can still see those words. It doesn't blur like it does on an iPhone or a typical phone. We've seen that in some gaming phones, I believe Razers and a few others. It looks nice. It's silky smooth. It's hard to go back from. How do you like that on the Pixel 4, Shirlin?
It's really nice looking. Everything looks really smooth. I've also used the OnePlus 7T, which has a similar refresh rate. So great. They both look, you know, this is our new world. It's all going to be upgraded to that standard, I think, moving forward. Problem is, and I hate to burst your bubble, but I'm the bubble burster today.
Google's, I mean, you're not bursting your own bubble. So, yeah.
Oh, boy. Google is not applying 90 hertz at every to everything.
It's, and like, variable, right?
Yeah, it adapts to what you're doing. And that's fair because not everything is compatible with the new refresh rate yet. So at the base level, when you're you know, looking at video that's like regular video that's shot at 60 frames per second, then it'll be like 60 hertz. When you're doing things like you know, using battery mode, for example, battery saver mode, then it's like, all right, we'll tune down to 60 hertz because 90 hertz drains the battery.
More refresh rates means, yeah, your screen is being like updated more quickly. So
exactly.
That is much harder on your battery.
And so the Pixel 4's battery life is already generally disappointing. So you don't want to like take that more.
Man.
And the problem is Google seems to also be tweaking your refresh rate based on your phone and your ambient brightness. So if your phones, and this is some code that like an Android developer unearthed and analyzed, and it looks like Google, the Pixel 4, when it detects that your brightness is set to 75% or lower, will set the refresh rate to 60 hertz.
What?
And then if you go up brighter than that, it'll go back to 90 hertz. And this is redonkulous.
That makes no sense at all. I cannot think of like an effective reason to do that.
We've had to speculate. I asked Chris, I asked V, like, what, why? Why would they do this? And he was like, well, maybe. Like, obviously, the goal is to save battery. And maybe the reasoning here, and we're speculating hard on this, is that like maybe at a lower brightness, you won't observe the smoother screen as well as
maybe
you did at a higher brightness. So maybe that's why, right? But Google did issue a statement yesterday saying that it has some previously planned tweaks that are coming up that will fix the, you know, that will enable 90 hertz in more brightness conditions. So, you know, eventually they'll come. I'm not like hype. I don't need it to be 90 hertz all the time. I'm fine with that. The problem is, though, like, again, that brightness thing is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
OnePlus told me yesterday as well that it's also doing the similar thing on the 7T. So it is enforcing 90 hertz when you're scrolling and when you're watching compatible content. But when you're looking at static things or you just like have some sort of battery mode on, perhaps 60 hertz is the base level. So it's not the way of the future right now. Like, it's not
so I shouldn't
right
feel
now.
Bad that it's not on,
on
my
the iPhone
11 Pro, although it's a Pro phone. Pro phones should have Pro features. Come on. I do feel like next year, with next year's iPhone and next year's wave of phones, this is going to be a big thing.
I think so,
because it looks so good. High refresh rate stuff in general. Maybe I just still have a Gemini Man on my mind right now, and I wrote that up at Engadget, but high refresh rate stuff, it's astounding. It's fantastic. I love seeing it.
The trouble is battery life, and they're going to have to keep figuring out how to get more.
Gotcha. Excellent. Well, that is the Pixel 4, Google's latest flagship phone, which Shirlin likes Google. And what are your overall thoughts, Shirlin?
I like it. I'm slightly disappointed. I like it, though. I just
like
can't switch.
After that was, like, that was a while. That was a lot of, like, just going down the negative.
I have a lot of complaints, but I will say they're not unfixable. And
Shirlin, the unflappable Google stan. Let's move on to the XPS 13 2-in-1, which I reviewed a couple weeks ago. And I just want to talk about, because it is, it feels so good.
If I am the unflappable Google stan, you are the dull XPS fanboy.
Yeah, because they're good. I'm not making excuses.
You're like every honestly, before I worked at Engadget, can I say something about
you?
You reviewed the Fitbit, one of Fitbit's like the Alta or something, and I had reviewed it at my previous publication, and I was like,
oh, now we're doing competing reviews. Okay, let's do this.
I'm
rolling
like,
up my sleeves.
Listen, this isn't not, like, this is still not stylish. Fitbit made a big deal about how this looks good, and I'm like,
style
this doesn't
is
look
subjective.
Good. Style is subjective. Meanwhile, Devendra Hardwar over at Engadget, which a publication I respect a lot, was like, this is beautiful. I'm like,
it It is beautiful. Well, okay, I'm not gonna fight about Fitbit because I don't care about Fitbit. But compared to their ugly, their very very ugly devices before, like I think any Sheena thing would be nice. Xperia 13 2-in-1. It is not just one of the best convertibles I've ever seen. I think it's pretty much like the pinnacle of ultra portable laptop design. It is super thin. It's very fast thanks to those Intel 10th generation CPUs. And the big thing, too, is that those 10th gen CPUs have really fast integrated graphics. So I was able to play Overwatch at like 720p. I had to lower the settings, but it still like played well. It went above 60 FPS at some points. Like, it feels good. It has a maglev keyboard. So even though it is it's like a very shallow feeling keyboard, they still feel very nice to type on. Like, there's a nice reaction to it. That's something I was worried about as they like thinned out the keyboard compared to the base XPS 13. You've seen it, Shrillin. How do you think it compares to everything you've reviewed?
I have been touching a lot of ultra portable laptops lately. Touching them, using them, you know, just caressing them. Mm-hmm. The XPS 13 is nice. There are a lot of nicer ones coming out. Listen, I saw some today that the company is like not ready to like fully reveal yet, but they're like, yeah, you can hint at it. There's some like coming up. They're really, really nice. I'll point to.
Yeah, I feel like this is going to be a whole new wave of laptop design, right? But what did you see?
Yeah, so I'm not going to tell you what I saw, but I'll point to other laptops like the Galaxy Book S, right? The HP Elite Dragonfly, which the company marketed as lighter than air, which is like, all right, what is
didn't
lighter
you,
than air?
But you didn't really like that computer.
The Elite Dragonfly?
Yeah.
I mean, it's more of like a mainstream laptop. It's not like the highest spec thing the way the Dell XPS line is, but it is pushing boundaries in terms of what we think of a laptop is, you know, for weight and for size, right? So I think that that sort of design is coming down the line for all laptops. And that brings me full circle back to why the Surface Pro 7 just needs a design upgrade. Anyway.
And that's the Surface Pro X, yeah.
That's the Surface Pro X we've talked about.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a lot of really sexy laptops out there. I mean, the Concept D line was introduced this year by Acer.
You're calling an Acer laptop sexy? That's
Have you played with the Aspire series?
Hey, they're
that whole
fine.
Glass cover thing? Oh,
they're fine.
Oh, that's beautiful.
There's that. So I feel like the main takeaway here is that I love the XPS 13 2-in-1. If you are planning to upgrade your laptop anytime soon, maybe wait a little and see. First of all, see what's coming up for Black Friday. But if you can wait into next year, I feel like we're going to see some really interesting thin designs based on Intel's new hardware and maybe some new stuff coming out. But it is a really good time to be into laptops.
I feel like we got to thank Intel's Project Athena for this, too, because Athena is pushing companies to make really thin and light laptops that are very powerful
as well. Is it, though?
Well, have you seen some of these?
I've seen some of it. And the XPS 13 2-in-1 is part of the Project Athena initiative. It is this thing that Intel announced. We heard about it first at CES, but we heard more at Computex. Where, it's their new, similar to like the Ultrabook initiative. It is just like basic design specs, right? A basic amount of battery life, a decent amount of thinness. It's them just trying to make certain things required or at least standardized. But it's not going to be like a label, right? It's not going to be something you actually find on a computer. It's just like an ideal.
Right. For the person that's buying a laptop, you're not going out and asking, hey, where's this Project Athena laptop? But it is, I think, one of the reasons companies are able to make such thin and light devices and that we're going to see them more of them next year. So I'm really stoked. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, they're gorgeous.
That's cool. We're going to see a whole bunch of computers. Something else that just came into the office. I spent last week playing with the Vive Cosmos, which is HTC's long-awaited follow-up to the original Vive. And that was one of the first VR headsets to really make consumer VR a thing. So there was the Vive, there was the Oculus Rift. The Cosmos is here. I'm a little ambivalent about it. I think as a high-end VR headset, it is certainly a nice follow-up to the Vive. The problem is it's coming today. It's coming in October 2019. And it's delivering features that we've seen from Oculus's devices pretty much over the past year. And it doesn't quite compete with something like the Oculus Quest. And something, you know, I spent a bit of time at the Oculus Connect conference a couple weeks ago. And that's where they really turned the Quest into something very, very interesting. So I reviewed it as like a plain standalone VR headset. And it's really impressive for that. But I found, you know, it's a little underpowered. You can only really do so much with it. At Oculus Connect, they announced a feature that lets you plug in a USB-C cable into a gaming computer and just use it as a desktop VR headset. And I think that is astounding. So that turns that $400 standalone device into a proper VR headset. It effectively makes the Rift S kind of obsolete too, which was Oculus's slight follow-up to the Rift. The Quest is basically like the VR headset to beat right now. And yeah, I don't think the Cosmos can really compete. The Cosmos is $700. The Quest is $400. The Cosmos has inside-out tracking, so you don't have to set up sensors. Its motion controllers are fine, except they look like straight-up copies of the Oculus remotes. And I also reviewed the Valve Index a couple of months ago, and I feel like right now that is the pinnacle of high-end VR, because that whole system costs $1,000, but using it, you can really understand why. Like, it's a much more comfortable headset. It uses these cool finger tracking controllers. It really pushes VR forward. Whereas the Vive Cosmos feels fine, like really fine high-end headset, but it doesn't really push anything forward. If they had given this to us maybe a year ago, I would have loved it. Right now, it just seems a little overpriced, a little late. So that's disappointing. But I think it shows that the VR market is getting stronger and getting better. So that's my big takeaway here. Like, the Oculus Quest is going to be a huge deal this holiday season. Keep an eye out for sales. Like, if you're looking to gift yourself something, or if you're looking to dabble with VR a bit, I feel like it's a decent investment based
Which
on everything we've seen.
Also funny because, like, the standalone mobile VR headsets like Gear VR or Dejan VR are just dead.
They're dead. They were a stepping stone. Right?
Yeah. There's no real like entry point to VR anymore in the same way, in mm-hmm. that way.
Well, so there's the Oculus Go, which is also another self-contained $200 headset. It's fine. You could do some basic VR games in it. You could do some 360-degree video. You can see some really nice stuff. But I feel like anybody who's really interested in VR should just spend the extra $200, get the Quest. You can play games like Superhot. You can play, you know, games like Space Pirate Trainer. And then if you happen to have a gaming PC, you can just plug it in and get some really nice high-end VR. And that just seems super useful. It's going to get hand tracking next year, too, which is going to open up all sorts of new interactions for VR games. It's just very good. And the Vive Cosmos just came a little too late, unfortunately.
Poor thing.
Poor thing.
Elsewhere in reviews land, though, I mean, it's not just you and I doing reviews. Uh-huh. We've got all our coworkers. We've put all of them to work. Listen, everybody is sweating. You have in the Echoes.
I have the new Amazon Echo, which is fine. I'll be writing a review about how fine it is, but nothing like revolutionary.
And I have the Nest Mini. We have other people working on various other companies' devices that I can't mention all of them. I can say we have a Pixel Book Go in the office, mm-hmm. and Nate Ingram's testing that out. Our review's due to come out
soon.
Let's
try to get Nate on for that, just because Nate is probably the only Chromebook fanboy that I know.
No. He's not the only. I'm somewhat of a Chromebook. I mean, not that's kind of obvious because I'm a Google stan, but we'll see what Nate thinks. And it'll be nice to have him on here for sure.
So let's move on to some fun stuff, our Engadget picks. And my first one this week is Watchmen, the new HBO show developed by Damon Lindelof. It is a sort of sequel to the classic graphic novel. And I've seen the first episode. I freaking love this show. It is so good.
It is
like a post-superhero thing. Like, the original Watchmen was like a deconstruction of the superhero mythology and the whole idea of superheroes and kind of what they mean.
I loved that movie, yes.
Yeah. Oh.
The one with Manhattan guy?
Oh, man. You're just killing me. You're killing me here. Okay. Yes, the movie exists. Thankfully, the show is not a sequel to the movie. The show is an actual sequel to the graphic novel. And I think, you know, Watchmen for its time was a really groundbreaking thing because it really made us think about superheroes in a different way, in a slightly more mature and darker way, and made us think about the idea of heroes and kind of what they mean. And this show is interesting because it is about something that no superhero could solve. It seems like it's about racism.
Oh.
It is about like fundamental issues facing our society. This show opens with not a huge spoiler here, but this show opens with the Tulsa riots, which is a thing that actually happened, like a, you know, basically a widespread destruction of the richest black neighborhood at that time. And I've never seen this depicted in TV. I've never seen it depicted in movies. It's astounding to me that the show just opens with that. And It reminds me of like the opening of the first X-Men movie where it's just like confronting injustice at the beginning. And it's like giving you a sense of like what this story is actually about. And, you know, the big villains of this new series are a band of white supremacists, basically, who are taking on Rorschach's mask and his imagery and his kind of like just shitty crime fighting mentality. Like the idea of Batman or any crusader just going really, really dark and really bad. Now they're essentially white supremacists. It feels so timely. It feels so real. And it's also really well done. Anything you're watching, Sherlyn?
Me? I am watching The Good Place all day, all night. Just Good Place, give me all the time.
It's good.
It's really good. This season has been interesting to see. It's a lot of like, I want to know what the ultimate ending will be. And it's right up my alley of like sci-fi, religion, moral philosophy, apparently, and sitcom.
And sitcom. Mm-hmm. And Ted Danson. It's everything. I also really want to quickly talk about CBS's Evil, which is a new show. It's from the creators of The Good Wife and The Good Fight and was it Brain Dead? I love all their shows. I think they're some of the best TV writers around. I spent a lot of my life convincing people to watch their shows because The Good Wife does not sound like a really interesting thing, but it turns out it is one of the smartest, funniest, most entertaining TV shows ever made. I think The Good Fight is the best deconstruction of like Trump's America that we've seen so far. So I love them as writers. Evil is a supernatural procedural. If you think of like the X-Files, except mostly focused on like religious supernatural phenomenon, it is a team, you know, it's about a team of people who go around investigating weird stuff like exorcisms and possessions and trying to determine if it's real, if it's fake, if there's something, you know, wrong going on there. It is really cool. It stars Mike Coulter, a.k.a. Luke Cage, who has another show, RIP Netflix Marvel shows. But he's just really cool. He's really badass. Asif Manvi is in the show as basically himself from The Daily Show as the tech geek, who I'm sure we'll all love and appreciate. What I love about the Robert and Michelle King is that their shows always have a really nice, deep understanding of tech. The Good Wife was probably the only TV show that really took the idea of government surveillance and wove it into the plot perfectly. Like, they understand tech. So not to spoil too much, but in Evil, there's already been like potentially a possessed Amazon Echo or Echo-like device.
Oh.
There is potentially a haunted AR experience, which does sound pretty frightening. Like the idea that you could put on a headset and see this unreality and you don't know what's real or not. And is it a ghost?
Is it a digital construction?
Is it AR? I find that all really fun. Sherlyn, I think you in particular, with your love for religious iconography, you'll really be interested in this.
I feel like I'm being misrepresented. I feel like you don't understand my passions very deeply. It's not religious iconography. It's more like ghosts. Give me more ghosts.
Give me more ghosts.
I want things that like prove to me there's life after death, even if it's grim and gruesome. But okay, so that's why I was watching The Good Place, right? So this does sound really interesting. You threw out the two words supernatural procedural, and
yes.
I was like, I'm in.
Yes.
I am in.
There are possessions. There's like, it's kind of creepy and scary at times too. So it's a perfect October Halloween show.
It's perfect. I've been finishing up Haven, so I'll start right on Evil. I have been reading the one that's my Engadget pick for today, which is. I mean, in addition to reading Jonathan Haidt's, like, The Righteous Mind, I've been reading Ali Wong's new book. I have to admit that Ali Wong is someone that Devendra recommended to me. And I was resistant from the beginning because...
Anything I recommend, Trillin's like, no.
Yeah, exactly. But she is hilarious. I watched Always Be My Maybe and was like, oh, she's actually kind of cool. So her book...
People love her for some reason. Huh.
Yeah. Her book launched October 15th, and it's called Dear Girls, a series of letters to her daughters. And I just... If you like her brand of humor, you're going to love this book. It's such a candid, like, mother talking to her two kids, but, like, also, like... You know, you two kids are going to be assholes if you don't do this. Like, just really, really straightforward, but also kind of a look at all sorts of things. So I actually took some screenshots today. And, you know, that's to me is a mark of a great book, which is when I can't wait to share parts of this book with my friends. And one of the things that I took a screenshot of was how she just like so accurately pointed out what it means to be an immigrant living in America, especially East Asian. She's Vietnamese, and she was talking about how she went to Vietnam for a study abroad course when she was younger, and all the people in Vietnam were telling her she was fat. And I was like,
"You all have seen pretty skinny."
You all have seen Ali Wong, and maybe back in her youth she might have been a different size, sure. But it struck me at my core because I was like, I grew up in Singapore, and in Singapore I'm fat. Like she, she talked about how she went into a store and tried to buy clothes, and the people would stop her from trying the clothes on because they're like, it will rip. And I have had the same experience where I'll walk into a store and like people in Singapore, like in boutique in Singapore, would be like, "We don't have anything your size." I am a size 6. I am a size 6. I used to be a size 4. I am a size 6 now, maybe sometimes a size 8. Mm-hmm. But Singapore just doesn't accommodate that. And so there's a lot about Ali Wong's experiences that speak to me. And
have
I think,
you seen her Netflix specials, by the way?
You've told me to do this and I haven't.
The things that put Ali Wong on the map. I'm glad you're liking her book. Check out her specials. They're
I will. She's really good. I feel like, you know, she might come off sometimes as a little too crass for the people who are a little more sensitive, but I appreciate how real and self-assured she is. And yeah, that's
I think the right amount of crass for Sherlyn, certainly. Yes. Finally, a quick shout out to The Outer Worlds, which is a new game coming out from Obsidian, some of the folks who've worked on Fallout. This is basically a Fallout game in space set in like a crazy hyper-capitalist society. It is, you know, I've never really gotten super into Fallout games, but it feels like a combination of Fallout, Mass Effect, and Firefly. And those are all things I really enjoy. So I'm really digging, like, going around this world, you know, going on space adventures. The writing is very good. The characters are very good. You're basically hopping around from different planets, going through missions. But it's a first-person game where you're basically inhabiting the life of some sort of space pirate or character, whoever you want to be. I find it to be really fun. And the really cool thing about this is it's going to be on Xbox Game Pass. So if you're already subscribing to that thing, which is already pretty inexpensive, you'll just be able to play this game on Friday. So yeah, check that out.
And that's it for our show today, you guys. Thank you for listening. Music was created by our managing editor, Terrence O'Brien, and the podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra. And I also podcast at slashfilm.com about movies and TV. So go check out the Slash Filmcast for more there.
If you want to reach me and you can be nice, you can find me on Twitter at Sherlyn Low, C-H-E-R-L-Y-N-N-L-O-W. Send us any questions or feedback. You can ping us on Twitter or email us at podcast@engadget.com. Come back next week for a brand new episode.
We're out.